This week on Vaticano, experience the outpouring of love and support for Pope Francis during his recovery at Gemelli Hospital. We also commemorate the 20th anniversary of Pope John Paul II's passing and take a reflective look at the origins of church councils. Vaticano starts now. Pope Francis returned home to the Vatican on Sunday and has been assigned a two-month resting period at Santa Marta. During his stay at Gemelli Hospital, he was receiving postal messages of love and support from all around the world. The Italian Postal Service, or Poste Italiane, was flooded with handwritten letters addressed to the Holy Father since his admission to hospital. Rome's central Fiumicino post office has been redirecting and sending all this mail straight to the Vatican, witnessing the overwhelming support the Holy Father has been receiving from all corners of the globe. Antonello Chidichimo, head of the sorting center, gives us a picture of exactly how much mail the post office has been dealing with.
Recently, since our Holy Father has been hospitalized at the Gemelli Hospital, we have been registering an increase in the volume of correspondence, both from home and abroad, up to a daily maximum of 150 kilos.
Handwritten letters are a disappearing art, so receiving them today holds a lot more personal meaning, especially when they're written by little hands.
One of the things we noticed while sorting through this correspondence is that many letters are written by children. So, with some surprise, we imagine that, in general, a young person, a child, would use more advanced technological means. Yet, returning to the use of paper always has a special charm. At the moment, we have recorded this increase in volume and mail, especially addressed to Pope Francis. Certainly, to wish him a speedy recovery. With this increase in volume and correspondence addressed to the Pope, all operators say they feel great pride and passion.
As Pope Francis begins his journey of recovery at Santa Marta, messages of support continue to pour into the Vatican. Post offices all around Rome are keeping up with the high demand to ensure that this simple yet powerful act of connection remains uninterrupted, allowing expressions of solidarity and love to reach the Holy Father. People worldwide are living longer. By 2030, one in six people in the world will be aged 60 years or over. The well-being of the elderly has always been a priority for the Holy Father. At the Holy See Press Office, a press conference set the stage for a more transformative dialogue on global health and longevity. Key speakers included Archbishop Vincenzo Paglia, president of the Pontifical Academy for Life, who saw the example of Pope Francis as a lesson from which to learn.
I think that Pope Francis, in these days in the hospital, launched a great magisterium about the fragility. Accept to be fragile. This push that all of us has to help each other. If we are obliged to take care of each other, it is more difficult to fight.
Father Alberto Carrara, president of the organizing committee, and Dr. Venkatraman Ramakrishnan, the 2009 Nobel laureate in chemistry, also attended the conference, discussing an interdisciplinary collaboration to reach one common goal.
The aim is not to get people to live much longer, but the aim is to have people live healthier lives.
Adding a personal dimension to the summit's theme, Professor Giulio Maira, esteemed neurosurgeon and founder of the Atena Foundation, spoke about the role of resilience and inner strength in overcoming illness. Drawing on his experience as the former director of the Institute of Neurosurgery at Rome's Gemelli Hospital, he remarked,
"We must face the overcoming of illness with a serene spirit, because healing often comes from within. Being depressed, being bitter about what happens to us reduces our immune defenses, which in turn worsens the progression of the illness itself."
Following the press conference, the inaugural Vatican Longevity Summit convened near the Vatican.
Hello and welcome to this week's Vaticano Updates, the most important news from the Holy Father and the Vatican. The Vatican launched new pastoral care guidelines for the protection and promotion of human life. The 40-page pastoral framework document highlights the urgent need to respond to Pope Francis's call to solidarity and fraternal love for the great human family in a society that has lost its ability to identify good and evil, the Holy Father wrote. The Vatican's new guidelines were created to help local churches to implement the principles which condemn abortion, surrogacy, euthanasia, human trafficking, and sexual abuse. Pope Francis urged the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors to continue to keep watch while the world sleeps. In his written message, he has also called the group to care for victims and survivors by listening to their experiences. The Holy Father asked the Commission to build alliances with civil authorities, experts, and associations outside of the Catholic Church to improve the prevention of abuse. King Charles and Queen Camilla postponed their visit to the Vatican at the advice of Pope Francis's doctors. The royal couple was set to visit the Vatican in April to celebrate the 2025 Jubilee, but after the doctors said the Holy Father needs more rest time following his recent illness, the audience was cancelled. King Charles shared his good wishes for Pope Francis' recovery. He and his wife will go ahead with the other components of their April state visit to Italy. Pope Francis has gifted his Presidential Medal of Freedom to the Metropolitan Cathedral of Buenos Aires. The medal is the highest honor given to a civilian by the United States, which former President Joe Biden decided to bestow upon the Holy Father in January. The Holy Father has decided to send the medal to the Buenos Aires Cathedral, where he served as Archbishop and Cardinal Primate until the conclave that elected him the successor of Peter in 2013. Cardinal Claudio Guttarotti appealed to all churches to support the Christians in the Holy Land. The prefect to the Dicastery for the Eastern Churches underlined the importance of re-establishing a genuine and meaningful dialogue. In view of the ongoing conflict with the terrorist organization Hamas in the Holy Land, Cardinal Guttarotti said the church must defend the sanctity of life. Thank you for watching this week's Vaticano Updates. In Rome, Andreas Tonhauser for EWTN Vaticano.
In just a few moments, revisit the legacy of John Paul II and meet Gustavo Zerbino, the remarkable Andes survivor mentioned in Pope Francis's autobiography. It has been exactly 20 years since the world held its breath and Pope St. John Paul II returned to the House of the Father. Yet despite the passage of time, his presence remains strong, and his legacy continues to inspire millions around the world.
On Java.
He is at work, and it is visible. People turn to God through him and receive various graces, many of them.
Two miraculous healings through his intercession, Sister Marie Pierre from Parkinson's disease and Floribet Mora Diaz from a terminal brain aneurysm, paved the way for his canonization, just 9 years after his passing. His impact went far beyond these miracles.
John Paul II changed the world, and the world that we live in today is in the shape it's in, or at least in some aspects, because of John Paul's witness, especially when he went to Poland in 1979 and inspired the people by saying, "Be not afraid," and that asking the Holy Spirit to send and to change the face of this land, this Polish land.
A drugi moi drodzy, to jest ta stuła papieska, w której do was teraz przemawiałem.
In Poland, his homeland, was just the beginning. The winds of change swept across Eastern Europe.
Gorbachev told the Pope, "I have read your documents, your encyclicals, and have come to the conclusion that something must change in Russia."
My first trip to Poland was in 1980, a year after his visit, and The decorations were still out in front of the houses, you know, the flags, the pictures of the Pope, and you know, everybody knew that this was
a beginning of change,
the beginning of the end.
Yet in the fight to change the world, danger was always near, and the cost of freedom proved to be extremely high.
The Pope was standing, and I was sitting beside him. The second time we approached near the Bronze Gate, the shots were fired. The Pope was still standing. I even asked him where, and he showed me. His abdomen had been shot through, and his hand was wounded. As he lost a lot of blood, he became weak, and that's when I held him up.
The Pope miraculously survived the assassination attempt in the Vatican on May the 13th, 1981, firmly believing that it was the intervention of the Mother of God that saved him.
The Pope knew about the devotion to Our Lady of Fatima, but nothing beyond that. Then, while still in the hospital, the thought of the Fatima secret came to his mind. He asked for the text, kept in the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, to be brought to him at Gemelli.
His faith deepened even further. Cardinal Stanisław Dziwisz, his personal secretary for 39 years, recently shared exclusive insights with EWTN in Krakow, testifying about the Pope's conversations with Sister Lucia of Fatima.
She said, "What Our Lady desired and what was written in those records has been fulfilled." And as a request, she asked the Pope to consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, together with the bishops, in St. Peter's Square.
And so he did. John Paul II, a tireless pilgrim, a messenger of peace, an avid athlete and skier, a polyglot, and a true friend of youth. But above all, he was a man of deep prayer, the source of strength behind everything he did.
He always ended his day with a moment of prayer. Whenever he returned to the nunciature, he would go straight to the chapel to pray, always, without exception.
His holiness was most evident in his prayer. He was a man of profound and unwavering prayer. He never displayed it openly, but those close to him could see how long John Paul II prayed.
Salve Regina, Mater Misericordiae.
He had a deep love for the rosary, and it remained with him until the very end, even when he could no longer speak. And on the last day of his life, those in his apartment prayed it for him, joined by a crowd of young people in St. Peter's Square, all united in prayer.
We would carefully and discreetly open the window just enough for the voices to reach him, so he could feel the joy of knowing that all those people were there with him. A large group of young people had been keeping vigil for the second day. I went out to the square and told them, "Go home." But they replied, "He was always with us, and now we want to be with him." And they stayed. The youth never left him until the very end.
Life is more powerful than the forces of death.
Friday, October the 13th, 1972, a Uruguayan plane carrying 45 passengers to Chile crashed in the Andes Mountains. Young men from the Old Christians Club rugby team and some of their relatives faced temperatures of negative 22 degrees Fahrenheit and lack of food, which led them to eat the bodies of the deceased. Only 16 people survived, and they've dedicated their lives to remembering their friends who never returned home. Gustavo Zerbino is one of the survivors, and in this interview, he recalls that life-changing moment and explains how faith sustained them during those days in the Andes.
Gustavo Zerbino, on October 13th, 1972, the plane in which you were traveling with your rugby team crashed into the Andes Mountains. What do you remember about that moment?
Well, you're taking me back to a key moment, a turning point in my life. In that instant, you're singing and jumping with your friends because you're heading to Chile for a long weekend. And suddenly, in just a second, an air pocket drops you 1,000 meters. The pilot wants to do everything possible to keep the plane from crashing directly into the side of the mountain. So he gives it full throttle, and the plane seems like it's going to break apart. And at that exact moment, right before impact, I unbuckle my seatbelt and stand up. I did the complete opposite of what you're supposed to do, and I felt a whoosh because the plane went into a stall, hit the nose, and broke apart like the cap of a pen. I realized I was alive, and when I took a step back, I sank into the snow up to my waist. At 4,500 meters of altitude, there's no oxygen. Your heart races. The air won't fill your lungs. Your mind moves in slow motion, and your ears and nose start bleeding. You try to stand up, but it feels like you have a 100-kilo backpack on your back.
At what point did you all decide to eat the deceased in order to survive?
We were waiting for the rescue from the outside world. The day we heard on the radio that they weren't looking for us anymore, we realized that the only way to survive was by our own means. The decision was taken unanimously. It wasn't done until we all agreed.
At this moment in the mountains, on those cold, bitterly cold nights, embracing each other, giving each other warmth, in that silence and solitude, the only thing you could hear were the little rosary beads, right?
Yes, at night. For 73 days, every night, we prayed the rosary for three reasons. First, to thank God, because we were alive, and ask the Virgin for strength. That day, even though 8 had died in an avalanche, we still gave thanks for being alive. Just being there was reason enough to be grateful. The second reason was that in the darkness of the night, no negative thoughts could take over our minds. And the third was that there were 16 of us, sitting in a circle, and every 5 minutes, someone had to say the rosary out loud, because if you fell asleep, you would freeze to death.
Gustavo, did you have any conversations with God in those days?
All day long, but we had a direct connection. God was the friend who gave you water, who caressed your feet, who embraced you. He was love. In the midst of the mountain, you feel so small, so insignificant, while the mountain is so vast, so immense, that you can truly sense the presence of God.
How was it the day you were rescued?
No one rescued us. We got out on our own. We crossed the mountains ourselves because Parado and Canessa stoically walked for 10 days, climbing and trekking through the mountains, enduring temperatures of negative 40 to 31 degrees Fahrenheit, something not even a person with proper gear could withstand.
On the 50th anniversary of the accident, you wrote to Pope Francis, and you asked him to join in the Eucharistic celebration with you all. Do you remember?
Yes. I met the Pope. I was with him 4 times. We carried out many high-impact actions around the world with Scolas Occurrentes. I wrote to him and told him that this 50th anniversary was important for the world because significant things had happened in the Andes. The Virgin had played a key role. God had given us strength, and we understood that a celebratory and Thanksgiving Mass would be meaningful. It would be good to have a message from him.
What have the years since been like?
Wonderful. Every day when I wake up, I have 1,440 minutes to do whatever I want. I'm happy. All the things I do in the world remind me every day of my friends who died physically, but live within me, and every person who is in front of me is a brother. That's why life is full of hope and a great commitment.
It has been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back after a short break with a special look at the origins of the church councils. Around 50 million people visit Turkey every year, but many forget. Although only about 0.2% of Turks are baptized Christians, the traces of the once Christian region are still visible.
Turkey is so important. It's very important because the first creation of the new Christian community has been here, with St. Paul, with St. Peter, with John, the apostle, and with the presence of Mary also.
In collaboration with the Turkey Tourism Promotion and Development Agency, the Turkish Embassy in Rome, and the pilgrimage organization Opera Romana Pellegrinaggi, a group of journalists and priests traveled to Turkey from February the 17th to the 21st.
Questo pellegrinaggio è molto importante.
This pilgrimage is very important because we are going to visit the sites of the councils and therefore Turkey and the Holy Land of the Church.
The group was led by Don Giovanni Biallo and Sister Rebecca Nazzaro, who is the director of Opera Romana Pellegrinaggi. The group followed in the footsteps of the first seven ecumenical councils, all of which took place in what is now Turkey.
Qui è molto forte, si sente questa.
You can feel very strongly here that the Catholic Church breathes with both lungs, East and West. And so we really hope that we can relive this unity together as it was at that time.
The first stop was Ephesus. In the year 431, at the third ecumenical council held here, the Holy Mother of God was proclaimed Theotokos, God-bearer.
Ephesus is important for many reasons. The council and there is a church, what remains of the church of the council, and very close to the archaeological site, there is the basilica that was built on the grave of John the Apostle.
In the Bible, the Acts of the Apostles describe how the Apostle Paul stayed in Ephesus for some time and was attacked by an angry crowd in the theater. On the onward journey to Iznik, the group also passed other historical sites, such as Pergamon, which is also mentioned in the Bible. About 2 hours away from Istanbul lies Nicaea. Today, the small town is called Iznik. It's not only the birthplace of the Catholic Creed, but also the scene of two councils. The Creed was established 1700 years ago at the First Ecumenical Council, and the so-called Byzantine iconoclastic controversy was settled at the Seventh Ecumenical Council in 787. The church where the bishops gathered at the time is now a mosque. Four important ecumenical councils were held in Istanbul, formerly Constantinople. Here in the Hagia Irene, the Church of Peace, in 381, bishops and theologians discussed the divinity of the Holy Spirit. Not far from the center of Istanbul stands the Church of St. Mary. The Council of Chalcedon took place in this neighborhood in 451. There, the assembly proclaimed that Jesus is truly God and truly man. But in Istanbul, the Hagia Sophia stands out in particular, having experienced a checkered history. Built in 537, the Hagia Sophia served people for 916 years as a church. The fifth and sixth ecumenical councils were held here in 553 and 680. After the conquest of Constantinople by the Turks, the basilica was converted into a mosque. Bishop Massimiliano Palinuro has been leading the Apostolic Vicariate of Istanbul since 2021. Here in the diaspora, he feels the wound of divided Christianity particularly acutely, as he told the pilgrims after he celebrated Mass with a group in Istanbul.
This city made me very sad, because if you look at it with careful eyes, this city bears the wounds inflicted by history and bears the wounds of Christian divisions. This city, which was the capital of the East, of the Christian East, because of Christian divisions, because of our counter-witness, it is today an Islamic city, because of us.
Di fatto è oggi una città islamica, per colpa nostra.
The experienced priest and pilgrim guide, Father Giovanni, will not let himself be robbed of hope.
Because I see the fruits of the presence of Jesus, of of the Holy Spirit in the life of the people. Especially for us priests, it's so fantastic, wonderful, really, to recognize how the Holy Spirit gives new hopeness, new forbiddenness, and mercy, and change the life of many people. The Lord is still working hard among us.